Stein argued about neither issue because neither one was an issue in his comment.
That's exactly right.
How's that? How's that for a segue?
That's a nice segue, yes. Thank you, Tom.
It was outside the box.
That's right.
Your box, outside the limit. How's that?
That's excellent, yes. So let's pick up where we left off. This is our last, you know, it's sort of a shame we are only doing two meetings on Wittgenstein. It's really pretty interesting. But anyway, I sort of stopped in the middle of everything last time because we ran out of time. So I want to pick up, but let me kind of just recap. So what I'm in the process of doing here with this magic marker, by the way, which is erasable. Laura very nicely went through all the magic markers last time, and this pile of magic markers over here, apparently, some of them work even, but you can't erase them. Mm-hmm. So she left me with five erasable magic markers. So that was a yeoman's duty. Well, anyway,
she's an attention to detail.
Well, they've lasted many years. We've had this tray for goodness knows how long.
Good.
Well, anyway,
next time you're in Staples, pick up a couple.
Well, yeah, maybe. Actually, black would be nice because it shows up better. But anyway, I'm in the process of filling out a four-column matrix here. What Wittgenstein is trying to do. And well, let me back up. I was tempted to bring in this one quote that I have read twice to my Ollie class and also included in an email because I thought it was so clever, but I decided not to bring it. But the person was saying, you know, the Tractatus became sort of the Bible of the logical positivist movement. You know, it was written, well, it was written in World War I, but it was published in 1922, and the logical positivist movement started in 26, maybe somewhere in there, 24, 26, I'm not sure. But anyway, so they were later, but they looked back at what Wittgenstein was saying, or at least how they interpreted what Wittgenstein was saying in the Tractatus, and thought, this is great. And the person who wrote the article that I thought was so clever and that I read a couple of times said something like, you know, the Tractatus combines prophetic fervor with sibylline obscurity. and so it's a perfect, you know, religious text for this new movement, which some people had sort of a religious enthusiasm about, you know, like A.J. Ayer, who wrote the book Language, Truth, and Logic. He was the only English-speaking member of the Vienna Circle. Well, anyway, so what is it about the Tractatus that the logical positivists found so so compelling and so religiously, they got such religious excitement out of, as it were? And that's this box here. I mean, it's like the circle. I just drew it a square instead of a circle. I don't know why, but there it is. There is what can be investigated by science, and then there's everything else, right? And of course, the whole point with logical positivism in your circle, and whether you shrink it or you stretch it, right? That's the theme of everything we've been talking about all year. It really is, that circle is what defines legitimate objects of discussion, really. So for the logical positives who want to take that circle of Humes and Kants and shrink it, and more stuff is outside now, you can't really talk about it. You know, if it's outside, this is what's inside is what you can talk about. Okay, well, same thing here. What's in the square or in the rectangle is what you can talk about. And everything else is just nonsense. You're just kind of wasting your breath, or at least that's how they took it. Now, I will say that they didn't read their Wittgenstein carefully enough. And so it does have interest for religious people, surprisingly. But it will be interesting to see what people's take on this is once I finish my diagram over here. Well, anyway, so the first column then is simply describing in words what this picture represents, right? I mean, if you have this limit, which is nothing but the same as the circle that I was using before, same thing. Obviously, some things are inside the limit, some things are outside the limit, and other things are at the limit. Other things are defining what the limit is. Okay? So that's obvious. So outside the limit, at the limit, inside the limit. Fine. Then we got as far as the second set of distinctions in Wittgenstein's Tractatus. And this is probably the most interesting thing, but you don't know yet why it's interesting. But anyway, let me just say that for what Wittgenstein is saying is that any proposition actually has two sources of meaning. We typically focus only on one of them. That is to say, what is it saying? But Wittgenstein is saying also, well, a proposition shows as well as says. It shows something as well as saying something. Oh, and by the way, the two are mutually exclusive. If you say, what does it show? That question makes no sense because they're mutually exclusive. What it says is one thing, what it shows is another, but of course, because showing is not saying, you can't say what it shows. You can maybe respond to it, feel it, or something like that, but you can't put it into words. So it's like black and white. It's one or the other. It's like a rectangle chopped in half. This half is saying, this half is showing. They don't overlap at all. That's an important thing to remember.
Well, I'm a little confused. Can we pause for a moment?
Sure.
Let's take the Mona Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
Ruben and I can go there and we can look at it and have an opinion, and then he can describe to me, he says, what he thinks she's doing, what it's about, right? Mm-hmm. So the painting is showing itself, I guess, and then he's saying to me what he thinks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a question. Do you think that what you can say about the Mona Lisa, or what Ruben can say about the Mona Lisa, which would presumably be different things, do you think that somehow captures the essence of the Mona Lisa?
Well, I don't know, because the essence is a vague concept, right?
Well,
because let's say you want to talk about her enigmatic smile, right? And what did Leonardo mean by that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know what he meant. He never said, right?
Right.
As opposed to,
can you say?
No,
you see,
I can say my perspective.
Of course you can. But that's why
there's no right answer.
But
there is no right answer.
Unless Leonardo actually captured it somewhere, which I don't know.
But that's why I said, do you think that you're actually somehow capturing the essence of it? In my email to the Ollie people, I used an example from Dylan Thomas's Fern Hill, which you can use any artistic thing, And I said, you can talk about it. Of course we can. But we feel that it's almost like an asymptotic kind of thing. You never get to the true
100%.
Yeah,
because
the true beating heart of
it. I'm not Mona Lisa herself.
Well, no, it's because you know what it's showing. And you also struggle to put into words what you already know, and you realize there's always going to be a gap between what you say and what you know, because you already know what it shows. And that's how you know that there's a gap between saying and showing. So in other words, you can't, of course you can talk around it. Oh, I also think I use the analogy of a black hole. It's like, you can't see what the black hole is like. You can see the event horizon. Sure, you can see what happens around it, and you can talk about that. But as to what's going on in the black hole, no way you can do it. You know, it's the same kind of thing here. What it shows is, go ahead.
No, there's only three properties that you can tell from outside a black hole: its mass, its electrical charge, and its spin.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And my analogy is the visual part of it.
Right.
You can't see it. You have no way of. There's no visible light that can escape from it. So, I mean, if I take a picture of it, as recently came out, right?
And it's actually what's around it that you're getting a picture of.
Yes. Yeah. And so I'm using that as an analogy. So you're talking about the event horizon, as it were, when you're talking about the Mona Lisa, but you're not talking about the black hole at the center. That's my point. And you know it. And you know you're not talking about the black hole at the center, which means you know what it shows. You just can't put it into words. Why? Well, because Wittgenstein says, saying is here. Showing is here. You can't do both. They don't overlap at all. So that's what we're saying so far.
don't know.
All right, well, just hold that thought. Let me finish with my columns, because this is going to have a bearing on, maybe you can figure out where we're going with this already. It's going to have a bearing on religion. So anyway, next column. Let me just read you a few of these enigmatic,
just Pete.
Of these Sibylline utterances that you find in the Tractatus. The very first sentence in it is, you know, did I show you what it looks like? I don't even, you know, here's what it looks like. You see, everything's just numbered.
It's like Proverbs.
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Heraclitus. You know, philosopher who is just, you know, who just, where's right? See
he
it, Bonnie?
He was envisioning a future power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's like poetry.
Right. Yeah, kind of.
Future what?
Future PowerPoint slides.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah,
those,
yeah.
Those are bullets.
Oh, yeah, yeah, very, very terse. Very terse.
No, he was getting ready to tweet.
Yeah.
These were right, they're all tweets. Under 180
they would
or whatever.
Perfect, yeah, 40. You're right, they're all listed. Well, a few of them are longer, but, you know, here's another page. You can just see it's all, you know,
you
at see most two lines.
You should see if there's a Twitter account out there where someone's actually done it.
Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah.
Although in German, they would have been too long.
Nah. Now the German's on the left-hand side, which is, this is nice. This is a nice addition because you can look back and forth. Well, anyway, but let me read you the first tweet. The first tweet goes like this. The world is all that is the case.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Tweet number two. The world is the totality of facts, not of things. Well, that's an interesting comment because it would certainly disagree with Aristotle's common sense position. For Aristotle, when he's asking what is being, he decides, well, being is what truly is substances. What are substances? Well, substances are things, right? They're the thing that chairs and people and doors and lights and trees and that sort of thing. For Aristotle, the fundamental constituents of the world are things. For Wittgenstein, the fundamental constituents of the world are not things. They're not things that would be expressed by words. They're things that would be expressed by propositions, see? Facts, not things. The reason for this, and I can't possibly go into detail, which I did in my other class, but it has to do with modern logic. And in antiquity, I'll say this much at least. In antiquity, Aristotle, of course, is the father of logic. And Aristotle developed a logic of terms. And an Aristotelian syllogism depends on the relationships between the terms of the argument. If all lizards are reptiles and all, well, that's not very good. If all reptiles are vertebrates, how about that? And all lizards are reptiles, then all lizards are vertebrates, right? I mean, that depends on the relationships between lizards, reptiles, and vertebrates, right? It's the relationships between the terms. The Hellenistic philosophers, and alas, this all has to be reconstructed because their writings have all perished. I mean, just so much is gone. Chrysippus is the main guy. He's second century, the great Stoic philosopher, developed a logic of propositions. So, for example, we talk about modus ponens. What is modus ponens? Well, if P and Q represent propositions, modus ponens says, if P, then Q, P, therefore Q, right? In other words, if the temperature is greater than 100, then there's a danger of dehydration, say. The temperature is greater than 100, therefore, there's a danger of dehydration, right? We reason that way all the time. And then there's modus tollens, which is if P then Q, not Q, therefore not P. So that's the converse of modus ponens. Well, but the point is, in that particular case, it's the relationships between propositions, not the relationships between terms, that determine the validity of the argument. See what I mean? So in the case of lizards, reptiles, and vertebrates, that argument depended on the relationships between the terms of the proposition. But in the case of modus ponens, modus tollens, and many, many other argument forms, the validity of the argument depends on the relationships between the propositions and not the relationships between the terms. That's the point. So anyway, to make a long story short, modern logic has taken it that because you can actually express the logic of terms in terms of the logic of propositions, but not vice versa, then actually the logic of propositions is more fundamental than the logic of terms. That's the bottom line. I won't go into how that's possible. Yeah, just take my word for it. Well, anyway, that's where Wittgenstein is coming from then, because he's assuming that there's a there's a perfect relationship between logic and the world. So if the logic of terms is more fundamental than the logic of propositions, then correlatively, it must be the case that facts are more fundamental than terms. That's where he's going with that thought. So anyway, facts then are really important because the world is the totality of facts. The world is determined by the facts, and there being all the facts. For the totality of facts determines what is the case, and also whatever is not the case. The facts in logical space are the world. The world divides into facts. That's about five tweets I just read you, etc. So you get the point. As opposed to facts, we have his term form. I'll read you a couple more of these oracular tweets. You know, he numbered them all. This is 2.024. Substance is what subsists independently of what is the case. It is form and content. Okay. There must be objects if the world is to have unalterable form. Objects, the unalterable and subsistent, are one and the same, and so forth. Let me skip down a few more. Form is the possibility of structure. The totality of existing states of affairs is the world. Okay, and so forth. So we have then, my point is, I can continue this diagram here. We have facts which are inside the box. Facts are what scientists investigate. But what defines the box itself is the form. Just another way of saying the context or the framework, or whatever your favorite word is, which is what the box is the, as he says, it's the possibility of structure. In other words, what the form defines the possibilities that can be realized inside the box. It doesn't dictate what will be realized. It simply dictates what is possible. Let me give you two analogies. One from Aristotle. Aristotle talks about a science as an axiomatic system. Okay? In other words, just like when you took geometry in high school and you had your definitions, your axioms, and your postulates, and then you deduce theorems from that. Which the axioms of an axiomatic system don't dictate which theorems will actually be derived in any given textbook, say. That's up to the author, which theorems the author decides to derive, right? It does, however, dictate the possibility, the theorems that are possible, because some theorems, which cannot be derived given the axioms, of course, won't be part of the axiomatic system because they're excluded by the starting points, ultimately, right? So that's one analogy of what he's talking about. So the box itself is like the axioms of an axiomatic system. Another analogy comes from John Rawls, and he uses the analogy of he's talking about a baseball game, but any game would work, but he's talking about baseball, so let's talk about baseball. So they're the rules of the game. The rules of the game obviously don't dictate how the game is going to come out. That depends on how it develops, right? But it does dictate what is possible. For example, you can't have a ground rule triple. There is no such thing as a ground rule triple in baseball. You can't turn around to the umpire and say, after the umpire says strike three, and say, you know, I've always thought that four strikes and you're out would be far better. There's no such thing as, or five balls, or four outs in an inning, or something like that, right? So there are things that are excluded by the rules, but the rules don't dictate how the game plays out. It just depends on how it develops, right? Well, that's the kind of thing that Wittgenstein is talking about the form, is when he says it's the possibility of structure. It defines what's possible, not what's actual, because it defines the framework or the context within which what's possible can become what's actual. Okay. So that's the second. Now, I got to put a question mark here. Aha, remember, sibylline obscurity. We'll talk about that question mark in just a minute. But there's a fourth column that I want to fill out first. And this one, I can't really just pick a tweet from here and read it. It's kind of in several places, so I'll just kind of summarize what comes out. But he uses three words. In fact, I'll put them in German, and I'll put the English translation. The first one is Sinn, which is sense. The second one is, I guess it's two N's, Sinnlosigkeit,
wow,
which would be sense less, that's the lost part, ishkeitness, senselessness. Hmm. Okay, that's important. And then
unsinn.
And that's?
That's nonsense.
Nonsense, exactly.
Right.
So there's a one-to-one relationship then between our three, you know, outside the limit, well, let me start at the bottom, inside the limit, at the limit, outside the limit, but between that and sense, senselessness, and nonsense. Now, the first and the third are probably not surprising. I mean, remember, this was the Bible of the logical positivists. Mm-hmm. So the logical positivists would be more than happy to say that the only things that have sense are the things inside the box here, and that everything outside the box indeed is utter nonsense. As a matter of fact, the slogan of logical positivism is, the meaning of a statement is its method of verification. That's their slogan. The meaning of a statement is the method of verification. In other words, if you can't say what observations it would take to confirm or disconfirm a given proposition, it literally doesn't have any meaning. So you see Wittgenstein's association then of that with nonsense is something that would really resonate with a logical positivist. They would agree, absolutely right, totally meaningless. The things out here are just, you know, traditional metaphysics, for example. Oh, they think they're saying something. Or religious propositions, theology. They think there's, you know, they have a subject, verb, predicate sort of grammatical structure, and it leads people to think that they're saying something when they're really not saying anything at all.
Nonsense.
It really, and so therefore, yes, unsinn does indeed, for the logical positivist, describe the status of such propositions.
I mean, the problem is the way you described that was almost as a pejorative.
You're darn right.
Like, let's take the black
hole.
It is, right?
It is pejorative. Right. Well,
we can discuss what non-observable characteristics of a black hole might be because of other things, and that are unprovable.
But
that doesn't mean they're. So you can say there's no sense to observe.
No.
But to call it a pejorative to say that's all idiotic.
No. Okay, wait a minute. Let me just cool things off here. First of all, anything that you can say about a black hole, you can certainly reduce to observations. I mean, how do we know the mass of a black hole? How do we know its electrical charge? How do we know its rate of spin, right? Those are the three things you said, I think.
Yeah.
How do we know? Well, obviously, there are things we can measure. So if you were to say, well, what does that mean? And what that means for a logical positivist, what observations does that translate into? You can certainly say it. So it's not nonsense. At least those three things are. But anything else, yeah. I mean, of course, there's debates. And did it come up in this class or in my other class?
Speculating whether they'll all evaporate in 100 trillion years.
Yeah, kind of things like that. Or I was thinking about string theory. You know,
can't prove it. It's speculation. Well, that doesn't
you're
mean
darn
it's
right.
Nonsense.
Okay. What was it? I mentioned string theory. I think we mentioned that last week.
That's right. Because it's not provable.
Yeah. And of course, scientists or philosophers do sort of disagree. And sure, that's fine. I mean, there may be a gray area whether string theory is here or here. Right? I can see that. Or you're in the example of in a billion years, what's going to happen to a black hole? Maybe indeed something we can never know. You know, or I think the thing that was mentioned last week here as well was the Big Bang. You know, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, does that question even have any meaning? You know, is it just utter nonsense? Now, Tom doesn't like the word nonsense. Okay, fine. But the logical positivists were very happy with that word because, indeed, they did want it to be a pejorative because they thought that traditional metaphysics was, in fact, nonsense and that nobody in his right mind should ever go there.
Except that's where many of the interesting questions of...
You're right. You're right. And Wittgenstein would agree.
The other possible translation of unsinn instead of nonsense would be unsensible.
Actually, it is. Unsinn is nonsense.
But it's always translated. I mean, in the Tractatus, they all the translators translated
nonsense. And it's used all the time.
But we will discover. I'm going to mollify Tom. I wasn't going to say this yet, but I'll just mollify Tom. I'm going to say we will discover that for Wittgenstein, there's good nonsense and there's bad nonsense, as it turns out. So it's not a pejorative term in Wittgenstein. It was for the logical positivists because they liked the negative part of it. But it will turn out that it's not going to look like that for Wittgenstein. But anyways, I was about to say, it's pretty easy to see how what's inside here, somebody of a logical positivist stripe would say that is sense, and what's out here is nonsense. The hard one is, why does Wittgenstein call this Sinnlos? Why does he call the boundary itself, why does he call it senseless? Because to our ear, and maybe to an ear of a native German speaker too, to our ear, that sounds a lot like nonsense. But he wants to make a distinction between nonsense and senselessness. What is that distinction, and why does he use the term senseless to describe the box? Well, here's the reason. Let me back up. Let me tell you a story. This is actually a story that Karl Popper tells, but it's relevant. It's sort of like a parable. And I think once I tell it, it'll maybe become clearer why he wants to call it senseless. Well, anyway, so Popper is talking about the situation in Austria right after World War I. And he says, you know, it was just chaos. It was chaos. The Austro-Hungarian Empire fell apart, et cetera, et cetera. And it was chaos in the intellectual world, too. And there were all these theories. And there were, talk about religious commitment. There are a lot of, the people who are just utterly committed to some of these theories. And he says, well, there were four of them that he found interesting at the time. This is in the early 20s. One of them, I should say the early 1920s, shouldn't I? Because this is 2022.
But
we got it done.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, I was talking to Kathleen. I didn't even know her name. In the choir the other day, I said, what is your name? I've seen her for a while. Do you know who I'm talking about? Kathleen?
No.
Singing soprano. Up in the front row.
The very tall lady?
No.
No, okay.
No. She's my age, as it turns out. I'll have to ask her what day she was born. But anyway... And she
said, stop where you are.
No. And she said, I've been here for 3 years. I said, 3 years? Of course, part of that was COVID, you know, so I guess I have some excuse. But anyway.
That was COVID.
Anyway, so in the 1920s, Popper says, well, there are four theories making the rounds that were kind of interesting. One was Einstein's theory of general relativity. Another one was Freud's psychoanalytic theory. A third one was Marxist economic theory. Mm-hmm. And a fourth was Alfred Adler's theory of personality, which I'm not as familiar with. Mm-hmm. I've heard the name Alfred Adler, but I don't know anything about. But apparently, he was the one that Popper was closest to. I think he and Adler had some sort of personal relationship. Well, anyway, he says all four of these had their enthusiastic religious followers. But then one day, he came across an article or something, I don't know, that seemed to him to be a problem for Adler's theory. Because, like I say, he was friends with Adler or something like that, or worked with him, I'm not sure. Anyway, there was this problem he saw. So he went to Adler and mentioned it to him. Much to his astonishment, Adler turned that data into evidence for his theory. And then Popper got to thinking, if a theory agrees with every single possible piece of data out there, is the theory telling you anything at all? And as a matter of fact, of the four theories that were making the rounds that all had their religious defenders who would always find support, and no matter what piece of evidence you mentioned, they would find it as support for their theory, only one of the four actually stuck its neck out and said what it would take to falsify it, and that, of course, was Einstein's theory of general relativity. You know what would falsify it. If in an eclipse of the sun, we did not see that star lurking in a direct line behind the star, then the idea that massive objects bend space, well, all objects bend space, but massive objects bend space in a noticeable way, would simply be wrong. And I'm back to the drawing board, you know? But of the four theories, that was the only one that said what was incompatible with the theory. See. And it was out of that that Popper developed his theory of falsification. If a proposition can't be falsified, it's really not telling you anything. If I say, for example, at this instant, it's really either raining or not raining outside, what have I told you? I haven't really conveyed any information at all. Of course it's either raining or not raining outside. I've covered all the possibilities. Exactly. It's totally useless. It seems to be a normal proposition, right? Subject, verb, predicate. But it's totally useless because there's nothing that's excluded by it. That's the point. So if you're talking about the boundary itself, then you're talking about what's possible. Therefore, anything else is not false, but just inconceivable. See, therefore, it's like these statements that Popper was talking about that can't be falsified. Not that it's not useful to say something about the boundary, but the point is, since it is talking about the boundary as opposed to what's inside the boundary, the negation of any of those propositions is just inconceivable. One of the propositions, for example, is any statement is either true or false. Right, I mean the principle of non-contradiction. If I negate that, it doesn't even make any sense at all. So anything at the boundary is going to have that kind of status. And so senseless is not a pejorative. It's not meant to be pejorative. It's simply meant to point out that the negation of any statement as to what's at the boundary really doesn't make any sense at all. And so it has a fundamentally different logical status from propositions that are inside the boundary. Okay? So that's the point of that tripartite distinction. Now let me read you a bunch of stuff at the very end of the Tractatus. Things don't really get going until like three pages before the end. But this will reveal what the question mark is.
What, do you write a cliffhanger or something?
Well, we got, 15 minutes? All propositions are of equal value. The sense of the world. Here's a long tweet. This is probably too long for a tweet, but maybe not for the extended 240 or 280 character tweet. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. In other words, the meaning. The meaning of the world must lie outside the world. In other words, out here. The meaning of life must lie outside the world. In the world, everything is as it is, and everything happens as it does happen. In it, no value exists. And it, if it did exist, it would have no value. One of these obscure things. If there is any value that does have value, it must lie outside the whole sphere of what happens and is the case. For all that happens and is the case is accidental. What makes it non-accidental cannot lie within the world, since if it did, it would make itself, it would itself be accidental. It must lie outside the world. So too, it is impossible for there to be propositions of ethics. Propositions can express nothing that is higher. It is clear that ethics cannot be put into words. Ethics is transcendental. Ethics and aesthetics are one and the same. Okay. So I'll pause briefly here. So one of the things that is in this question mark here is ethics. Another one is aesthetics. In other words, questions of value. Why? Well, because all this stuff here, what are they? They're facts.
Right.
We don't find values in the world. No. If we're going to talk about value, it has to be outside the world. So too, and now here we get into a bit of religion here. This is very spinozistic. So too at death, the world does not alter, but comes to an end. Death is not an event in life. We do not live to experience death.
Right.
If we take eternity to mean not infinite temporal duration, but timelessness, then eternal life belongs to those who live in the present. Our life has no end in just the way in which our visual field has no limits. Not only is there no guarantee of the temporal immortality of the human soul, that is to say, of its eternal survival after death, but in any case, this assumption completely fails to accomplish the purpose for which it has always been intended, or has some riddle solved by my is some riddle solved by my surviving forever. Is not this eternal life itself as much of a riddle as our present life? The solution of the riddle of life in space and time lies
present?
Outside
oh.
space and time.
Space and time, okay.
It is certainly not the solution of any problems of natural science that is required. How things are in the world is a matter of complete indifference for what is higher. God does not reveal himself in the world. The facts all contribute only to setting the problem and not to its solution. It is not how things are in the world that is mystical, but that it exists. To view the world sub specie aeterni, in other words, under the aspect of eternity, is to view it as a whole, a limited whole. Feeling the world as a limited whole, it is this that is mystical. When the answer cannot be put into words, neither can the question be put into words. The riddle does not exist. If a question can be framed at all, it is also possible to answer it. Okay, I'm going to skip that. We feel that even when all possible scientific questions have been answered, the problems of life remain completely untouched. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are then no questions left, and this itself is the answer. You know, before there, I should bring this, I should have brought, but I think I remember how it goes. In a letter to a friend of his, he says something like this. He says, oh, I wish I had brought it, but I can repeat it pretty much. He says there are two parts to my work, something like that. He says there is what I have written, and then there's all that I have not written. And it is precisely the second part that is the important one.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's kind of along the lines of course there are no questions left, and that itself is the answer. The solution of the problem of life is seen in the vanishing of the problem. Is not this the reason why those who have found, after a long period of doubt, that the sense of life became clear to them, have been unable to say what constituted that sense? There are indeed things that cannot be put into words. They make themselves manifest. They are what is mystical. Okay. Let me just pause real briefly. There are only three tweets left. Let's talk about this question mark here. I said, you know, what belongs here, of course, are propositions of ethics, propositions about the Mona Lisa, that is to say, propositions of aesthetics, that anything having to do with value falls in here. But also questions of the meaning of life. Also religious questions, theological questions. And also traditional metaphysics. Okay. Now, let me read the third from the last, the antepenult, the antepenultimate tweet. The correct method in philosophy would really be the following: to say nothing except what can be said, i.e. propositions of natural science, i.e. something that has nothing to do with philosophy. And then, whenever someone wanted to say something metaphysical, to demonstrate to him that he had failed to give a meaning to certain signs in his propositions. Although it would not be satisfying to the other person, he would not have the feeling that we were teaching him philosophy, this method would be the only strictly correct one. So, yes, there is not. This is all nonsense. This is all nonsense. But there's good nonsense and there's bad nonsense. Metaphysics, in the one I just read you, like Plato's theory of forms, you know, which he would say, a good Wittgensteinian would say, oh, you know, the whole theory of forms is just based on confusions caused by language. I.e., you know, for example, you know, Patty is a word, and that word points to that object there. Triangle. Well, that's another word. Well, that must point to an object, but there is there's nothing called triangle in the abstract in the world. Therefore, it must point to some entity in another realm of reality. He'll call it a form, of course. So, I mean, a critic of Plato could simply say, well, and this is in line with what a Wittgensteinian would say, is that Plato was duped by language. You know, Patty and triangle are both nouns, and so there's the assumption that triangle must behave in the same way that Patty behaves, right? And therefore must point to an object in the same way that Patty points to an object, right? Well, of course, that's simply a confusion that's caused by language, and that's where Wittgenstein is coming. That's where he's coming from. Metaphysicians have to have that pointed out to them to show that what they're saying is really nonsense. It's outside the framework. It's really nonsense, and it's bad nonsense, so it's pejorative in this sense. However, there's good nonsense, too. There's ethics, there's aesthetics, and probably more than anything, there's the meaning of life, which he calls the mystical. That's good nonsense. And there's theology. There's the propositions of religion, too. That's good nonsense. So there's, well, actually three kinds of nonsense. The third kind of nonsense is this book. And this is what he says about his own book. This is the penultimate tweet. My propositions serve as elucidations in the following way. Anyone who understands me eventually recognizes them as nonsensical. When he has used them as steps to climb up beyond them, he must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he's climbed up it. So once you've got the point of this book, you can just throw it in the trash, he's saying, because this also is nonsense. Why? Because it's partly metaphysics, right? The very beginning of it, remember that I read, the world is composed of facts, not of things. That's metaphysics. That's out here. It's nonsense. But it's special bad nonsense because it's useful. It's useful because if you read my book, he says, then you will realize that bad nonsense really is bad. And once you figure that out, you can just toss this in the trash bin, right? So this is a third category. It's bad but useful nonsense. And then the final tweet. What we cannot speak about, we must pass over in silence.
Oh, yes.
Sally. Did you hear that? Yeah. Well, anyway.
I think that goes when you go to a funeral service.
Oh, yeah.
You cannot speak, you know, just...
Well, he's talking about speak about in the metaphysical.
Right. So statements can move across the border.
Not you shouldn't say anything. Right. Yeah. But anyway, think about this over the summer. I wish we had time to, you know, I really wish we had more time to talk about it some. But here is this is how some religious people have taken Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein is saying, right, that there's such a thing as good nonsense and questions about the meaning of life, which is what a lot of religion is about, right? is nonsense, but it's good nonsense, okay? And he's also saying, right, that it's not saying anything at all, because saying is confined to things inside the limit. So not only is being at the limit just showing and not saying, but things beyond the limit also are showing and not saying. So here's the bottom line. If you recite the Apostles' Creed, or if the Apostles' Creed comes up as something to be done in the service of worship, and you can't believe hardly a word of it, Wittgenstein gives you an out. You can say, I accept it as showing, even though what it's saying, I can't believe a word of what it's saying, but I accept what it's showing. That's the bottom line. So that's why it's of interest in a religious, well, in a Sunday school class, because of that particular take on what religion really is. It's a good thing. It's a good thing, but it's also nonsense. But it's also showing and not saying. So nothing that we say, nothing that we talk, well, that's not true. But as long as a hero confines herself to theology, it's all just showing and not saying, even though she appears to be saying things. See, that's the bottom line.
So would he care whether Jesus actually existed or not?
Maybe not. I mean, you know, that sort of follows.
Or is the collection of works what's really important? And not whether he was the Son of God.
Yeah, but I mean, those formulations seem to say something, but they really don't say anything, but they do show something. But if you ask, what does it show, you can't answer that question, because showing and saying are in two different boxes. They don't overlap at all. You say, what does it show? There's no answer to that question, because saying is here, showing is here. See, isn't that clever? I think it's interesting. I'm not saying I particularly buy it, but it's worth thinking about and worth considering and mulling over. I think it's an interesting take on it.
And he didn't say that there needed to be, at least keep drilling down, all, turtles all the way down. You know? Do you need some facts at the bottom?
No. It's like the Mona Lisa, or it's like,
well,
you know,
at least the Mona Lisa, there's a painting there.
Yeah. But there's the Apostles' Creed, right? It's one's in words, one's in paint, so what? But, you know, it's all showing. It's all showing.
What's the question mark? It's really, this breaks down into three things, right?
There's good nonsense, there's bad nonsense, and then there's the Tractatus, which is useful nonsense. Yeah. Yes.
If that survives until the fall, we'll wonder, what the heck?
Yeah.
What is tea?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I'll remember what it is. Must be truth.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have put WN. For
yeah. Well, we're out of time.
Thanks so much.
Well, Don, I hope you, maybe you'll hear from some people, see whether we can get them back.
I think Warrenetta maybe has moved. I haven't seen her for a couple of weeks.
Warrenetta has moved.
Okay. Laura was here last week. You weren't here, Bonnie, but Laura was here.
I couldn't have.
Yeah.
There are many others.
And actually, she brought her husband once. That was not last week, a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, I would like, I don't like just having eight people or whatever it is. We used to have about 20 every single week. I've taught this class for 42 years. This is year 42.
Yeah, I'm
wondering, isn't that amazing?
Why the Nevis, the Nevin Locker? You know,
what's happened to Pat?
I don't know.
COVID, he's a COVID casualty. And, you know, they just kind of quit
when his
mother-in-law or father-in-law
died.
Yeah.
He had it a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So they're more.
Yeah. So, but yes, I would like to.
Yeah, COVID's taken its toll.
Of course it has, in a lot of ways.
And you know, Dan, it was Lisa, the one who told us about this class.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She said you got to.
Oh, there are lots of people that, you know, Heidi and Chuck.
And that guy who used to talk about the romanticists with the guy who would sit over there. I forget his name.
Jesse.
Oh, Jesse Draper. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, he's been gone forever.
Roger.
And Roger Conley, yes.
Yeah,
I haven't
Roger.
Even seen him.
Yes.
Yeah, there's all sorts of people that have been enthusiastic members, and well, sometimes their kids grow up, and you know, then they leave, and whatever. I've griped about that before, but Reuben, he's solid as a rock.
Am I the kid or the one that?
No.
My kid isn't grown up yet.
I know that, but I have faith in you.
Well, let me put it this way. I have no desire to move back to where I came from.
Okay.
It's way too red.
Okay. I don't know. Where was it?
Hoosier. I mean, from Indiana.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, okay. My parents don't live where I grew up anymore either, so. Mm-hmm. Although they still live in Indiana.
Uh-huh. Huh.
Just barely.
Right. Okay, well, anyway, we got to get to choir. So, anyway, see you guys next
thanks,
year.
John. Thank you.
Yeah. See you in the fall. Thank uh-huh. you, John. Mm-hmm. Thanks for keeping the Zoom option going.
Sure. Uh-huh.
That's true. Oh, yeah.